before beginning tape number two.
Tape number two ended, as I recall, with the mention that the Dominican Republic had been the other major issue in which Humphrey had been somewhat involved in calendar year 65. Then I think I mentioned that toward the end of 65, Johnson was becoming concerned with the fact that the liberal community was disaffected because of his Vietnam policy period. He still regarded Humphrey as having some entree to and credentials within that community period. Therefore, along about December, he started dropping some hints to Humphrey that he might want him to travel to Asia. There was some possibility that before Christmas, or right after Christmas, Humphrey might be asked to go on some trip to Asia, period. However, Orville Freeman mentioned something, as I recall, in late December, early January about this, and got into Rollie Evans' column, period. Thereupon, Johnson scotched the whole thing, period. Then the president and his advisors scheduled the Honolulu conference. There they met with Tu and Key and the other people from the Vietnamese government, as well as the top advisors from the U.S. government, period. A few days before Johnson went out to this meeting, he mentioned to Humphrey that he might want him to do some traveling afterward, so he should stay loose in terms of his schedule, period. By this time, Humphrey was so terrified of Johnson and his whole paranoia on leaks that Humphrey was very reluctant to say anything to anyone, period. I think he hardly mentioned anything about this to Muriel Humphrey, period. Anyway, the Honolulu conference took place, and as I recall, it was to adjourn about the 15th of February. I'm not sure of that date, 15th or 7th or something like that. Anyway, the night before it adjourned, Humphrey went to Chicago to give a speech, period. And at 11:30 that night, I had a call from Honolulu from Ben Reed, the Executive Secretary of the State Department, who was calling for George Ball, period. The message was that Humphrey was to be prepared to leave on a 2.5-week trip around Asia the following day. He was to stop in Los Angeles to meet the president, who would be returning from Honolulu the next day. And after meeting the president, he would then go to Honolulu, pick up President Chu, Prime Minister Key, and other officials of the Vietnamese government, as well as high-ranking U.S. officials, and proceed directly to Saigon, period. After that, he would visit other countries in Southeast Asia, and also in other parts of Asia, period. The recommendation was that he would spend about 2.5 weeks not only in Southeast Asia, but in India, Pakistan, Australia, New Zealand, the Philippines, Korea, prior to returning to the United States, period. He was to be prepared to leave at noon the following day, period. I remember expressing to Ben Reed my surprise at this, since we had no advance notice, no briefing papers, no inoculations, no staff arrangements, nothing. Ben said very little, being a discreet man, but he just merely conveyed the instructions that he was asked to convey. I then called the Secret Service to see when Humphrey was due back in Washington. They said he was due to be at his home in Chevy Chase about 1:30 that morning. Britt, I lived in Chevy Chase, D.C., about a mile or mile and a half from Humphrey's home in Chevy Chase, Britt. So I always remember I wrote out a memo, which Elizabeth Riley typed up between 12 and 12:30. Then I went over to Humphrey's house at 1:15. I drove in my own car. I had typed up, or I dictated, and Elizabeth had typed up a list of things that we had to do prior to leaving the next day at noon. We focused on the action items. That is to say, we focused on who we should take, that sort of thing, what we had to do between now and departure time. When I got over to Humphrey's house about 1:30, was there, and we talked for about an hour and a half until about a quarter of 3 or 3 o'clock, and planned the trip. Then the next morning we made some frantic calls to Jim Thompson and Carol Lace and others. We wanted to take on the trip. We got some inoculations and arranged to get others on the way out there. But anyway, Humphrey and I and a couple of other people took a Jetstar to Offutt Air Force Base and then to Los Angeles, and others piled on another plane, and we all met in Los Angeles where the president met us. We then joined him for a press conference and flew on that night to Honolulu. We stayed overnight at the Royal Hawaiian Hotel there, and next day we left for Saigon. I always remember it because we picked up Prime Minister Ki and President Tu, as well as the foreign minister and their ladies, and we piled them all on our plane. I always remember those Vietnamese ladies sleeping in those bunks up above in our plane there, and they were always crawling in and out. I also remember that up in the front cabin, Averell Harriman was talking with several people one day, and Prime Minister Ki was there twirling some pistols. He was a pistol fan, and he was twirling these pistols in the face of Averell Harriman, who was terrified. He thought they'd go off, but they never did. Anyway, we got to Saigon, and the whole trip was kind of set by our arrival in Saigon. What happened there, After all, this was the first major overseas mission that the vice president took, He had no briefing papers, no preparation whatsoever. In addition to his own staff, which were not prepared because they had no advance notice, Johnson had sent along Jack Valenti and Lloyd Hand, and at Honolulu we'd picked up Mac Bundy and Cabot Lodge and Harriman and Chet Cooper and Ed Lansdale and all sorts of other hotshots. It was a very frustrating thing because Bill Connell and I were supposed to be running the trip, Bill on the scheduling side, I on the substantive side, and yet in many ways Valenti and Hand were really calling the shots on the schedule, Valenti used to call Johnson every day. Anyway, we got to Saigon, and we went through the drill there, and it was clear that Johnson wanted Humphrey to make some optimistic statements about how things were going, I remember the first night we were there, the Prime Minister Ki gave a dinner about 9 courses per day. I always remember the shark fin soup, which was the first of 9 courses. I took one gulp of it and passed it by, but Cabot Lodge, who was our ambassador, went the whole course, and the next morning we didn't see him for 24 hours. He was deathly ill. I remember it very well because Phil Habib, H-A-B-I-B, who was later to be a negotiator in Paris, Assistant Secretary for Far Eastern Affairs, Phil got me aside and asked me to come out to lunch, which I did at his house. And Phil, though very loyal to the president and his policy, made a point of telling me he hoped Humphrey would have a chance to talk with some people aside from these very formal briefing sessions, period. He kind of conveyed the impression that there was a lot that Humphrey wasn't hearing, period. I agreed, paragraph. Also, we had made a decision to send our various people to do different things while we were there. Jim Thompson, who had worked with us in the campaign of 64 on loan from Mac Bundy, Jim knew a number of people, and he went off with Ward Just, who was the correspondent at that time for the Washington Post, into the field, and also, as I recall, with him, was a fellow who was on Ed Lansdale's staff named Daniel Ellsberg, period. As I recall, I want to check this, I think Ellsberg and Ward Just and Jim all went on to the field, period. It could have been the Dick Holbrook, who then worked for Porter, may have gone with him instead. Anyway, they went out in the field and came back with a report, which they filed later, which was radically different from the official reports which Humphrey got, period. Basically, the whole trip, beginning with the first stop in Saigon, was a disaster, period. Harriman, who regarded himself as the senior advisor and the person who really should guide the vice president, was very testy, period. I remember we all agreed that the major statements the vice president would make during that Vietnam trip would be a statement at a press conference, which you'd make the final day or the next to the final day that he was there, period. Therefore, I went to some lengths to prepare that press statement. I had prepared several drafts, and before preparing the final draft, Harriman got a hold of a semi-final draft, and he was very much upset with what he saw, and he came and collared me, and he said, "Young man, the president sent me out here to guide the vice president. If you release this statement, it's rubbish, it's rubbish, I'll repudiate it. You've done a terrible injustice, you've bypassed me. You don't know what you're talking about. If the vice president says this, he'll embarrass the country." And so forth. And I remember telling Harriman, at great respect, that this was just a draft, and the vice president had instructed me to clear any important statement in the final draft with Abel Harriman, for he was, after all, the senior advisor on the trip, and I fully intend to do that. Harriman and I had quite an exchange on that period. It was my first introduction to Harriman, and I was reminded afterward by Pat Moynihan's statement about Harriman being called the crocodile, period. He gobbled people up, period. He certainly gobbled me up, period. But after I assured him that we, in fact, did value his judgment and wanted to consult him and would release nothing without his approval, Harriman and I got along very well. And so by the time we drafted the final statement, which the vice president put out, Harriman was very happy, and from then on we get along famously. The visit in Vietnam really didn't prove much. Period. Humphrey didn't challenge too much the authority of Westmoreland Lodge and the others there. Period. Where we really ran into a more significant event and happening really was in Thailand. We knew that the situation there was very, very tricky. Period. Thompson and Harriman and Cooper had warned us about it. At Harriman's suggestion, we had sent Chet Cooper over from Saigon to Bangkok in advance to scout the situation, period. Cooper spent 2 or 3 days there and then came back to Saigon and accompanied us on the trip to Bangkok, period. The Thai government really wanted to get a high-level representative of the U.S. government to sign on to all their demands, period. Dean Rusk had been in Thailand about 6 or 8 weeks before and had refused to sign a communique which they had proposed, which would have, in effect, committed the U.S. government to certain open-ended commitments, period. That is why Harriman felt that it would be useful for Chet Cooper to go over there in advance, got the situation, come back. We reviewed the whole terrain and the policy questions at issue on the plane as we flew from Saigon to Bangkok. The Thais really laid it on heavy, and I always remember that probably the most elegant dinner given during the course of Humphrey's vice presidency was during the visit to Bangkok, period. But toward the end of that visit, actually the last night that we were there, I remember going into Humphrey's room to run over the next morning's schedule as we always did. And he said to me, what do you think of that communique? And I said, what communique? He said, well, that communique, he said, didn't Graham Martin show it to you? And I said, no. He said, well, I thought you saw it and Harriman saw it. And I said, no, I didn't see any communique. He said, well, you better get a look at it. Well, this is about 12:30 or 1 o'clock. And I said, well, I'd get a copy in the morning. He said, all right, fine. And so the next morning we had to leave relatively early. We're going to Pakistan, as I recall. And we got out of the plane fairly early. And I got on the plane. And as I got on the plane, I just was entering there. And Phil Potter grabbed Norman Sherman, Vice President Humphrey's press secretary, and was cursing him out left and right. God damn you, Sherman, you fucking son of a bitch, you whores for the New York Times, he said. You sons of bitches would sell out, and so forth. Anyway, he went on and on. And it was clear that Norman Sherman, our press secretary, was taking abuse for some major blunder on behalf of someone. What had happened, it turned out, was that Graham Martin, our ambassador in Bangkok, had got Humphrey in the car en route to a dinner the last night and showed him this draft communique and convinced him that this was something that made sense and that he should sign it. Humphrey was very tired and assumed that I had seen it, and Harriman had seen it, and it was okay, and it was routine, and so forth. And he said, fine. He looked it over and told Graham Martin to go ahead and release it. Martin, of course, hadn't showed it to anyone. He hadn't showed it to me. He hadn't showed it to Harriman. He hadn't showed it to Chet Cooper, Jim Thompson. And in effect, he tricked the vice president into signing something that Dean Rusk had declined to sign 6 or 8 weeks earlier, period. The communique was released very late that night, after most all of the correspondents had gone to bed. However, Tom Wicker of the New York Times, like most White House correspondents, was traveling with us, since we'd picked up most of the White House press corps in Honolulu, Tom had a stringer in Bangkok who got him out of bed about 2:30 at night, period. Tom got a hold of the communique, recognized the import of it, and filed a story and scooped about 50 White House journalists. Humphrey made a major mistake in signing that communique. He angered the press corps that was with him because Wicker scooped the whole crowd, But that was a minor point, And more importantly, as he would discover when he got back to Washington, he in effect did make some very strong open-ended commitments in that communique, which no other official of the U.S. government had made before or since. It later turned out this is a great mistake, To dwell on that point for a minute, when we got back to Washington and went before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, as I recall, we spent about 2.5 hours before the informal, off-the-record meeting of that committee, And about 1.5 hours of the 2.5 hour session was on that communique, Eric Severide and I believe it was Martin Agronsky, that had a special half-hour or one-hour interview with the vice president several weeks after he got back, focused on that communique, And it was during that discussion that Severide asked the vice president if he thought that the purpose of American policy was to build a great society in Asia, and if the vice president subscribed to that, and Humphrey said he did, This would later be used to hang Humphrey in the Senate and elsewhere, But the important point here is that Fulbright and Mansfield and Church and others on the committee used the signature of that communique as a way of really convicting Humphrey that he had signed something which made an open-ended commitment to the government of Thailand, which was really not approved by the Congress of the United States, and really had no basis in any legislative enactment or anything else. And this, of course, they were right, That was a major mistake, Graham Martin, as our ambassador there, had really tricked Humphrey. On the other hand, he should have been more skeptical and should not have signed that, it was the most important mistake in a whole series of disasters that occurred in that trip that Humphrey made, from there, we went to to Laos and India and Pakistan, Australia and New Zealand. It was in Australia that Humphrey made the famous statement about the fox and the chicken coop. He also made a statement on the flight from India to Australia in a kind of background briefing that he gave the reporters on the plane, that Souvanaphouma, the Prime Minister of Laos, favored the bombing of Red China, period. Savanna had told us that after a very good lunch in a private session attended by four or five people, including Bill Sullivan, Jack Blundy, myself, a couple of people on the Laotian side, period. Humphrey never should have said that, but he did, and it was reported and gravely embarrassed Savanna, period. He denied it, of course, period. By the time we got to Australia, Humphrey was extremely tired. Period. We all were, period. We had a particularly unfortunate meeting one night, which was actually the first night of our arrival, period. We had flown for 14 hours from India. Period. We had begun to deliberate about preparing the report which the Vice President would submit to the President upon return, period. Our administrative officer on the trip, Bill Connell, had emphasized the importance of getting started on this soon, period. He suggested we meet that first night, period. I dissented, saying that I thought that we could wait another day or so. Everyone would be tired out, period. He prevailed, and we agreed to have a meeting at 10 o'clock at the Ambassador's residence of the group that was traveling with us, period. Humphrey and Robert Menzies and Avril Harriman were dining together earlier. We agreed we'd start at 10 after they finished their dinner, period. It turned out that dinner went on to about 11 or so, or 11:20, period. And we started that meeting about 11:20 or 11:30 at night, period. Everyone was extremely tired, period. By this time, everyone had a few drinks, including Humphrey, period. I remember Harriman getting up about 11:30, about 5 or 10 minutes after the meeting started, saying that it was time to go to bed, and he was leaving, and he left, period. And then we started talking, period, and there's been a lot of discussion and some public reporting about that meeting, period. David Halberstam has it in his book, The Best and the Brightest, period. David's account is based chiefly on Jim Thompson's account, since David was extremely close to Jim and got most of it from him, period. No question that that meeting that we held at the ambassador's residence, that is to say Ambassador Clark's residence that night, was a disaster, period. Everyone was tired. No one had too much drink, but the combination of change in time zones, the fact that we were tired, plus a few drinks, meant that everyone was really out of sorts, including Humphrey Bird. We got talking about what kind of report we should file. Bird, at some time, we got onto the subject of the Chinese, and Valenti made some statement that if we don't stop them in Saigon, we'll stop them in Honolulu or San Francisco. And Humphrey picked up on that and more or less echoed the same theme, period. This was more than Jim Thompson, come an old China hand who lived in China and knew a lot about the subject, could stand, period. And he did not resist the temptation to say nothing and pass this off and deflect the conversation, period. Instead, he rather frontally took on the Vice President, period. He, in effect, put him down and said that he was wrong and this was not the case and this made no sense, period. It made Humphrey look very bad, period. Thompson was clearly right in the substance of the issue, but he was wrong in the timing and the choice of the occasion to say it. The whole thing went on for a while and broke up, and it was most unfortunate. The next day, Humphrey made a speech before a luncheon of the Australian government, which was attended by most of the leaders of the Australian Parliament, most of the people in the government, cabinet. But I remember one of the press people, I think it was either Hugh Seide or Pete Liskor, one of those people, Tom McCurr, someone saying to me that that was one of the worst speeches Humphrey ever made. Period. I agreed. I had written a text for him. Jim Thompson and I had worked it over, but he'd abandoned it. And it was a real right-wing diatribe. It was dreadful. One of the worst speeches I ever heard Humphrey make. Period. The Australians just ate it up. Period. At that time, under Prime Minister Holt, they were very, very hawkish in the Vietnam War period. That was the period in which Holt said that he was all the way for LBJ, period. That particular day, Humphrey was all the way for both Holt and LBJ, period. It was dreadful, period. I was embarrassed. A day later, we were I think then flying from Australia to New Zealand. When Humphrey and Averill Harriman and I were working on some statement, and I can't remember whether it was my suggestion or Harriman's that Jim Thompson be brought into the discussion. And we had the discussion just before we broke up. It's fairly brief. Humphrey turned on Thompson. And said something to the effect, quote, "I know what you think of me. You have no respect for my intelligence. I don't care what you think. I know what you think of me," unquote. Something like that in a rather angry way, period. It indicated that he was still smoldering over the exchange a day and a half before, period. It also indicated that though Thompson had written him a note apologizing to him, all was not forgotten, period. Although Humphrey would give Thompson a signed farewell autograph, farewell photograph later that fall when Thompson would leave the government to return to Harvard, there continued to be lingering suspicion that Humphrey never really regarded Thompson the same from then on. I often had occasion to reflect on that and how it was one more manifestation of the tremendous error made by Johnson in sending a senior official of the U.S. government, in this case the Vice President of the United States, on an important overseas mission at a time of delicate relations with a number of countries without any prior preparation, period. Looking back on it, it is really incredible to reflect that we went on a 2.5-week trip around Asia without one briefing paper prepared in advance, without any people lined up in advance, with no preparations made whatsoever, period. Not surprisingly, there were a number of serious mistakes made along the way, period. The exchange in Australia was one of them. I recall it was also about this time that that at the suggestion of Humphrey's staff, Humphrey broached the subject to Jack Valenti and Lloyd Hand about stopping for a day somewhere along the way to rest up a bit and focus on the report, period. We've been moving at a very rapid clip and everyone was very tired out, period. We sensed that it would really be best to stop along the way and get that report done and have it ready to deliver to the president when we got back, period. He sent a cable either directly to the president or had Valenti send it to the president requesting a one-day extension so he could stop in either Hong Kong or Japan or somewhere in that area, spend one day working on the report, period. The answer came back within a day or so in the negative, period. I remember being surprised at that, but on later reflection, it fit very well with the short leash that LBJ kept the vice president on. From the time we were in Australia on through New Zealand, the Philippines, and Korea back home, the focus of our attention was on the report that the vice president would give to the president, period. This really became the focus of all the discussions, period. We found that many people in our entourage had very strong views about what kind of a report should be filed, period. The views conflicted strongly, period. The Vice President's Administrative Assistant, Bill Connell, felt strongly that an optimistic report strongly endorsing the government of Vietnam and the President's policy vis-a-vis Vietnam was what was in order, period. Jack Valenti, for somewhat different reasons, felt the same way, period. I remember him saying on a number of occasions as we discussed it, quote, the president wants optimism, the president wants optimism, unquote, period. I also remember Valenti's unfailing courtesy in giving me any drafts he prepared and suggesting that if I thought them worthwhile, show them to the vice president, but do whatever I thought best, period. He didn't have to do that. And not everyone on the plane followed a similar procedure, period. But I remember, although disagreeing very strongly with Valenti's views, coming away with quite a high regard for him, period. Jim Thompson, Monty Stearns, who was then a special assistant to Averell Harriman, and I all felt alike on the subject, and our views were pretty close to Harriman's, period. So we all prepared various drafts and they circulated around with the first few days. Everyone read each other's and Humphrey read some of them, and period. I always remember Harriman got a hold of one draft, which I think had been written chiefly by Bill Connell at one point, and got very, very exercised about it, period. He went to the vice president and told him that if he put out a report like this, he would disown it, period. He had nothing to do with it, period. I remember Humphrey being somewhat upset about it because I think he suspected that Jim Thompson may have put Harriman up to it, period. Actually, Thompson had nothing to do with it, period. It just happened to be one of a number of drafts that were circulating around, and Harriman got the impression somehow or other that it was the working draft and got very excited, period. Harriman had very strong views about these things, and he didn't hesitate to express them, period. Anyway, I have in my files my own handwritten summary of the first draft that I did, which was done in a hotel room in New Zealand on February 21st, 1966. I also have the first draft done by Jim Thompson and by Monty Stearns. Both, all of these are in longhand. I remember we worked in a hotel and it was hot and worked very late at night. There would be many drafts between then and the time we actually got back to Washington the evening of February 23rd, print. We gained a day coming back, close print, so it really would have been the 24th, period. The preparation of that report was one of the most horrendous experiences I've ever had before or since. Period. I had already experienced a substantial number of times making policy by drafting, period. Also, by then, having worked for Humphrey for 3 years, I had been exposed to a certain amount of jockeying in the preparation of speeches and statements. Period. But the preparation of this report, which would end up being one of three important statements that Humphrey would prepare in his vice presidential years on Vietnam, turned out to be a fiasco. Our earlier instinct to stop somewhere for a day along the way and get the report done was proven sound, period. Although we worked all the time on the plane going back and had a draft finished when we arrived in Washington, there was no consensus on it. And Humphrey felt it needed further work, which it probably did, period. Immediately, further jockeying began by those who felt one way or another, period. One of my colleagues, I believe it was Bill Connell, showed the report to several people in the government, and the consultation process began to widen, period. We spent a lot of time the first day talking with various people, including Chet Cooper, I think Bill Jordan, Jack Valenti and Lloyd Hand continued to be involved, period. At any rate, I remember that in the late afternoon, on the first day we were back, Humphrey indicated that he wanted the report redone, and he wanted to review it the next morning, period. I remember asserting myself rather strongly at that point and saying that would be fine. What time did he want it? Someone mentioned something about 9 a.m. and period. I immediately interjected, fine. I would have another draft for him at 9 a.m. the next morning. Period. He asked me if I wanted any help. And he said that if I thought Ted Van Dyke could be helpful on it, I could call on his assistance, which I did, period. Paragraph. I remember being rather concerned and determined at this point for a number of reasons. Period. One thing that influenced me was a briefing that took place that morning, period. I think it was the first of two briefings that Humphrey did that day at the White House for members of the Senate and the House, period. As I recall, that was a split briefing, period. Anyway, I attended one of the sessions, the first one, I believe, period. The President was there and introduced Humphrey, period. A good number of the members of the Cabinet were there, including Rusk and McNamara, period. And Humphrey made a fairly brief report, 10 or 15 minutes as I recall. It was rather hawkish, but not outrageous, period. But the thing I recall most was that the two senators who stood up, among a number who made comments, close friend, and praised Humphrey's report and praised Johnson's Vietnam policy and strongly supported it, were John Stennis, chairman of the Armed Services Committee, and Strom Thurmond, period. I was very much struck by that these two men, whom Humphrey knew and respected as fellow senators in the Senate in earlier years, but with whom he disagreed in the most profound way on foreign policy, security policy, defense policy, were the only two people who really stood up and in effect strongly supported what he had to say, period. I could not help but think about the political distance he had come in so short a time, period, paragraph. That night, Ted Van Dyke and I worked till 4 a.m. Revising that report, period. We had some additional secretary help besides Ted's secretary till about midnight, and then Ted's secretary stayed till 4, period. We got the whole thing retyped, and we both decided that since there would probably be more fun and games in the morning, we would requisition a White House car and personally deliver the report to Humphrey's home in Chevy Chase, period. I lived nearby in Chevy Chase, D.C., and Ted Van Dyke not too far away. So we both took it out to his house first, delivered it there about 4:30 in the morning, and then went home, period. Later that morning, about 9 a.m., I got a call through the White House switchboard from my colleague Bill Connell, period. He wanted to know where the report was, period. He said the Vice President was waiting for it, period. although I was only half awake, I allowed as if the vice president shouldn't be too dissatisfied, and that I didn't think he would perish from unfulfilled expectation because the fact that we had dropped off reported his home several hours earlier, period. It was one more small and futile point scored in an increasingly frustrating exercise. Later that day, we would have a lot of people from the government involved in reviewing this report. Bert, I remember I think it was on the 28th of February. There was a farewell reception given by the Secretary of State at the State Department, 7th floor. 8th floor, I guess it is. For McGeorge Bundy, who was leaving the government on March 1st. And Humphrey or someone had cornered Bundy earlier and got him to commit himself to coming to a meeting to discuss this report. So there we were. We went over to this farewell reception. And after it was over, Bundy came back over to the executive office building, period. He was a good soldier, but he clearly wasn't very keen on this exercise. The discussion went on for about a half an hour, and I remember making a couple fairly sharp comments, and then turning to me and saying, John, I think you have my comments, and I don't see any reason that you'll need me anymore, and he walked out, period.
The whole exercise reflected very badly on the Vice President, I thought, because it got a lot of people from the State Department, the White House, the National Security Council staff involved, and kind of demonstrated the division of opinion from his own staff, his own advisors, as well as those State Department company. It didn't make him look very good.
I have in my file a memo dated February 28th on the subject of a trip report. Period, it's clear that by that time I was fed up, period. I will just mention a couple points made in that because it kind of gives something of the flavor and also one of the dilemmas that Humphrey had at that time. Following our quotes, this is to Humphrey from me. One, I recommend you give a brief confidential report to the president and issue no public report, the latter underlined. Paragraph two, if you literally have no choice in the matter, I recommend a brief report omitting most of the detailed documentation in Vietnam. Three, I believe the optimistic tone of the draft so far is unjustified and should be toned down. I see no advantage for you in making a public report that would be a sitting target for every critic of our Vietnam policy. If a formal appearance before this Foreign Relations Committee would make you an inviting target, a published report would repeat this 10 times over, period, paragraph. And then I go on and so forth. Then I say again, paragraph, quote, if the president personally insists that you issue a public report, I would frame one that would do him the most good and you the least damage. Period. In my view, this would be a brief report and not include the vast array of detailed material, come every aspect of which would be fair game for the critics. A paragraph. including that memo, which I'm sure is in the file there, I say that, quote, furthermore, the long string of optimistic reports on Vietnam by high U.S. officials has not helped the president. It has raised public hopes which could not be satisfied. You must be careful not to do the same. To get yourself into the position of McNamara a year ago would be helpful neither to you nor to the president, unquote. Anyway, we went back and forth for almost a week or more after we got back, maybe 10 days. Finally, we filed a big report with a summary. By this time, it had been clear that it would be the White House that would decide what kind of a public report was released, period. As it turned out, they issued a very brief pro forma, non-substantive, I think, two-page report the weekend, following the weekend after we returned, which would have been about 10 days after return, period. It just kind of confirmed the futility of the whole exercise, period. What value the long private report had internally, I don't know. I think probably the press did read it, period. Extent it circulated around the government in the final form, I don't really know, period. Paragraph. I guess we did draw on it a little bit. Afterward for speeches and that, so, but not, that kind of thing, but not much, period. In a way, it was a fitting climax to that trip, period. The trip, on the whole, did Humphrey a lot of harm, and that report was consistent with it, period. It was after that trip that he would later make a lot of public statements about Vietnam. The president encouraged him in this regard, period. That's really one of the main reasons he sent him out to Asia, period. Humphrey reacted in a natural way, but one that would do him considerable harm politically, and I think in other ways as well, period. He had been cut out of the whole Vietnam decision-making process in calendar year 1965, period. I think he saw the trip to Vietnam and the rest of Asia as a way to get back in the president's good graces, come and get back into participation in the at least discussion process, if not decision process. Period. Anyway, I think many felt he overreacted and became, 110% supporter of Johnson's Vietnam policy, period. I think it was that period between February of 66 and July of 66 that his own credibility was most damaged, comma, that his liberal friends began to desert him most rapidly, comma, that he most seriously undermined his credibility with many people, comma, including many of his traditional friends in the country, period. I would, paragraph, I would make one comment on a related but separate subject at this point, period. I mentioned that George Bundy was leaving the government on March 1st, 1966, period. I think some of Humphrey's friends, including perhaps some on the staff, may have felt at that time and may still feel today that Bundy took took initiatives to cut out Humphrey early in the game, and that Bundy played some critical role in cutting Humphrey out of the meetings where Vietnam was discussed in early 1965 and later, period. I think that interpretation is totally without foundation, comma, totally inaccurate, period. Bundy was extraordinarily cooperative with Humphrey in the fall of 1964 when he was running, period. Also in late 64, Bundy, comma, though he didn't know Humphrey well and I think had some doubts about him in the Kennedy years, comma, doubts which certainly were reciprocated on the part of Humphrey, comma, I think Bundy came to see Humphrey as an ally on one issue which was important with him for a while, the MLF issue, period. Bundy was always extremely cordial to me, and so far as I knew, to the vice president, period. And it wasn't until Johnson vented his own wrath after mid-February of 65 that Bundy began to reflect the president's views on Humphrey, and executed his instructions when it came to calling meetings and inviting certain people. Bundy was simply an accurate barometer of the president's own views, period. In this, he was not alone, period. I think that Humphrey never bought the view that Bundy was one of those who tried to cut him out, period. I remember that when Bundy let it be known in late December of, or mid-December, whenever it was, 65, that he would be leaving. I suggested to Humphrey that he give a farewell dinner for Bundy. Britt, I pointed out to him that Bundy was going to be an important man in American public life for a long time, comma, that it was my judgment that Bundy had a high regard for him, and that if Humphrey put some thought and effort into it, Bundy would very much appreciate a farewell dinner on his part, period. Humphrey agreed, and after some consultation, we agreed to have a small dinner, which Humphrey would give at his own home. And I think there were only 12 people that were going to be invited because that's all he could accommodate, period. I remember I have the list. Note about Bundy, this is just continuation on the other side of that tape. We set up the dinner and invited the people, which included Humphrey, Bundy, McNamara, Harriman, Congressman William Moorhead, Walter Lippmann, Henry Brandon, James Rustin, Dick Neustadt, Arthur Schlesinger, Carl Kazin, Ray Klein, Bob Comer, and John Riley, period. I always remember that Henry Brandon was in London when they cabled the invitation to him, and his publisher course, insisted that he fly back just for the dinner, period. As it turned out, once Humphrey was commandeered by the president to go to Asia, the dinner had to be canceled because it fell during that period. But I always think that Bundy remembered it, remembered the gesture, and years later, after Humphrey left office as vice president and would become the chairman of the board of the newly established Woodrow Wilson Center for International Scholars, Bundy went out of his way during the early months that was getting launched to be helpful, period. Although the Ford Foundation was asked for only a very small grant, as I recall, of about $50,000 or $60,000 to get it started, Bundy took a personal interest in it and moved it right along, period. I know because I handled that small grant, and I was struck by the fact that it moved extremely smoothly, thanks in part to Mac's own personal interest. The other significant thing I remember happening that spring, and I think it was just about a month or so after, a month or 6 weeks after Humphrey got back from Vietnam, that was the period that Fulbright was having those hearings before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on China. And he had a lot of academic experts in, period. Among those who made quite a impression was Doak Barnett, who was still at Columbia University, who would later go to Brookings, period. Doak had used the phrase of favoring a policy of, quote, containment without isolation, unquote, period. That went considerably beyond our stated policy up that time, which really was to isolate China, to withhold recognition of any kind from her, and to try and strongly persuade all our allies to do likewise, period. This was really an effort to open up our policy and to include some new options, period. Anyway, in a appearance on Meet the Press, would have been late March or early April of 1966, Humphrey used the same phrase of containment without isolation, period. Tom Hughes and Ted Van Dyke and I had spent an unusual amount of time in briefing him for this appearance, and we actually had some very precise language which I had prepared based on those hearings, period. As I recall, it was the column 8, page 1 story in the Monday edition of the New York Times, period. It created quite a stir in the government, and there were reports that Dean Rusk was quite distressed about it, period. Later reports suggest that the president was not unhappy about it, period. Anyway, it attracted a great deal of interest, especially in the small community of scholars and journalists and commentators who followed events on China, period. It was along about that time that a group of scholars in particular were forming a private organization called the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations, period. Bob Scalapino, professor of political science at Berkeley, was, I believe, the first chairman of that, and he came around to see Humphrey about that time, period. We had a lot of correspondence with that group, and I remember how elated they all were about what Humphrey had said, period. He later expanded on this remark some in a made your speech, which you gave somewhere later that spring period. Looking through my files for May and June, the summer period, I don't see anything at the moment terribly significant on Vietnam period. I do notice some interchange on a number of other issues, which indicates that Humphrey was not cut out during that period to the extent that he had been a year earlier. There's some exchange on Cambodia and the possibility of a Senate delegation going. This came up in June period. He did go to the inauguration of Balaguer, the Dominican Republic president, on July 1st of that year. I have a memo of June 16th talking about a meeting of the Committee of Principals, which discussed an important proliferation issue. I have another memo about a call from Walt Rostow to me asking about whether Humphrey had talked to Dirksen about a matter related to the World Bank, which George Woods and Henry Fowler, Secretary Fowler of the Treasury, were talking about. Those are important only in the sense they indicate that there was more interaction between Humphrey and the President's office then than before. I also have a memo here of May 11th telling Humphrey, this memo from me to Humphrey, saying that Harriman would like to see him, talk to him about the discussions that are now going on in Vietnam. It's clear that Harriman was not very centrally involved in those discussions, but he felt Humphrey should hear his views. This was particularly related to the possibility of initiating a negotiation at some point. I also have a memo of May 10th to Humphrey talking about the subjects that are going to come up in a meeting he'll be attending on Vietnam, where the two major subjects to be discussed in the agenda are the bombing of the petroleum installations in Vietnam, and secondly, the degree of our support for elections, despite the fact that the military government in Vietnam probably opposed them, period. Again, this indicates that Humphrey is participating in this kind of discussion in the government in May of 1966, period. A year before that, he wasn't at all. I also have here a rather interesting document, Humphrey's scratchings on it, a copy of a letter which we got back from Rusk on March 30th, obviously in response to a memo that Max Kempelman had prepared and Humphrey had sent over to Rusk over his own name. It was about the question of diplomatic recognition by Vietnam of Israel. The reply is fairly detailed, and precise, period. It's clear that Rusk's reply is not very sympathetic to the point that was made in the memo. I don't have the memo, but I can kind of read between the lines in this one, Paragraph. I don't think it's terribly significant, but it does indicate in the very precise, polite, but not in any way warm response on this issue, that Rusk continued to be very much aware of the problems that would be presented by the Vice President attempting to insert himself between the Secretary of State and the President, period. That's a constitutional issue in which Rusk was always very much concerned, period. It operated both ways with Rusk, period, because he was very much conscious of the constitutional role of the Secretary of State vis-a-vis the President and vis-a-vis the Vice President, comma, he made a point of meeting his obligations to the Vice President, whether that Vice President was Lyndon Johnson or Hubert Humphrey, but at the same time, he wasn't terribly tolerant if a Vice President attempted to insert himself between the President and Secretary of State, period. Everything I saw indicated that Russ took his responsibility to keep Humphrey informed every bit as seriously as he had with Vice President Johnson, period. It is well known that Rusk was one of the few cabinet officials in the Kennedy administration to treat the Vice President well, period. And I believe this stemmed not only from the fact that they both were Southern boys, this was later much commented upon, but the fact that Rusk had a very precise view of the constitutional role of the Secretary of State, and he adhered to it, period. Just going through this file, Norman, I came upon a memo I sent Humphrey on March 25th on the China question. Actually, it's not precisely on Vietnam, it is related. It states that Bill Bundy called Jim Thompson this week after reading the press roundup that Jim had prepared on the reaction to Humphrey's statement on China Meet the Press, which must have taken place just a couple days prior to March 25th. Bundy said the phrase, quote, containment without isolation, unquote, is, quote, most unhelpful, unquote. It gives the representatives at the UN the impression that our policy is changing and evolving, period. Thompson told Bundy that he flatly disagreed with him and felt that the Vice President's statement was an accurate description of the direction in which our policy should be moving. This just indicates that Humphrey's statement did get a good deal of attention, period. You'll recall that Bill Bundy at that point was the Assistant Secretary for Far Eastern Affairs and was a very influential guy in the government. I don't have much at all in the late summer, early fall of 66, period. And one memo from Humphrey, August 18, 66, mentions that he noticed that Chet Cooper is coming back to help Averell Harriman, period. I hope you're keeping in touch with him. Bring Chet over someday. I'd like to talk to him, period. This does indicate that Humphrey continues to be concerned about keeping in touch with people like Harriman, period. By this time, you'll recall, Harriman was very much on the outs and represented an alternative track on Vietnam. Therefore, I think it's significant that Humphrey continues to note those sorts of things. I also have a memorandum dated August 4th, 1966, which I sent to Humphrey following discussion with Betty Getz Lowell. She wanted to have a meeting with herself, her husband Arthur Lowell, and Al Lowenstein to talk about Vietnam, period. They, of course, dissented sharply from the Johnson administration's policy in Vietnam, but wanted to talk to Humphrey about possible negotiating alternatives, period. My recollection is that Humphrey did see them and had a discussion, period. This is one indication that as late as August 66, he did continue to see people like this and give them a hearing, even though he generally was increasingly less sympathetic to their views. Paragraph, I have a memo here of November 17th, 1966, talking about clearance guidelines and foreign policy speeches. Period. Among other things, it records that Rusk was quite unhappy with the speech Humphrey made in Oregon in November of 66. Period. It was a speech that was similar to something Arthur Goldberg did that week. New York, period. Rusk and Goldberg apparently had a big battle over the clearance. Period. Colbert really scooped part of Humphrey's speech. However, nevertheless, Rusk was unhappy with the speech. That Humphrey gave. Peretti apparently let Ben Reed know that and asked about how Humphrey's speeches were cleared. This is an indication of continuing sensitivity on the part of senior officials like the Secretary of State to what Humphrey said about the Vietnam issue. That concludes what I have on 1966. I'm going to end that tape now and send it in. The next one will begin with 1967.